Good morning, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Angel's Wing Weekend Chat with Junior from the Angel's Wing account. And we have our co-host Espresso and Casper also today with us here. And before we start, Casper, would you mind to give us a usual intro of the Angel's Wing first?
Yep, of course, June. Thanks. We are the Angel's Wing, an international NFT art gallery and podcast show founded by international friends who came together through our love for art and NFTs. Espresso and Johannes are from Europe, June's from the US, Rebel and myself, and we are from Asia. Our mission is to feature a talented, independent artists and other guests, of course, who have inspiring stories to share. We believe that art has the power to inspire and connect people through shared experiences. We do showcase the art in an on-cyber virtual gallery as a larger collection of art brings a cross-pollination of viewership that has helped quite a few of our artists reach collectors. Glad to say we've organically grown since into a community of artists and collectors, but most importantly, friends. With regular Twitter spaces like these, which are then recorded into podcast formats in Spotify and YouTube. The easiest way to get in touch with us would be to join our cozy Discord. Everything's on our link in our bio, so hit us up. If you're an indie artist who needs help featuring your art, or if you just want to join a friendly art NFT community, we'd like to mention that nothing on this show should be construed as investment advice. This podcast is for informational purposes only. And last but not least, if you do enjoy our show and want to support us, we welcome donations to our wallet, theangelswing.eth and theangelswing.tez. Whether it's art or ETH, thanks so much for tuning in. And with that, back to you, June.
Thank you, Kessler. Our guest today is Danielle King. Danielle is an artist, collector, writer, and curator in the digital art space. And Danielle is also the creator of The Muses, one of the first long-form generative AI art projects on emergent properties. And currently, Danielle, she is also the CFO and CEO of Club NFT and Right Click Save magazine. Danielle has a background in traditional art and finance. And in the past, she served as a manager of the Department of Painting and Sculpture at the Museum of Modern Art for 8 years. So welcome, Danielle. Very happy to have you with us here today. And I'm looking forward to hearing some of your unique perspectives. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me. I'm actually on a walk in the forest because weirdly, I get better reception there than I do in my house. So,
oh, wow.
You may hear birds or I'll be going by a river. So yeah, you might get some nice nature sounds.
That's amazing. Yeah, I'm also surprised that the sound is pretty good.
Oh, that's good.
So yeah, first of all, would you mind telling us a bit about yourself? And I would be interested to hear what made you transition from the traditional art to the digital art space.
Sure. Yeah. I think like a lot of people, the pandemic was a big turning point in my life. So I had lived in New York City for nearly 20 years working in the art world in a sort of financial operational capacity. I have a background in art history and studio art, which I studied in college, but then I also later got an MBA and worked on Wall Street. So my career, I've always like fused art with that financial side. So I was living in the city. I have two small kids. The pandemic hit and we were going insane in our little apartment in Brooklyn. It was just like too many people in a small space, so we couldn't leave. I think a lot of people who have kids and or who were cooped up in small spaces can understand just how chaotic that felt. My husband and I were both working from home. My kids were homeschooling, which really meant like we plopped them in front of Netflix all day while we worked. And it just wasn't sustainable. So we moved to the Berkshires in Western Massachusetts and were able to have a house and a yard and all that kind of stuff, which meant I had to quit my job. I was working at a big gallery in Chelsea at the time. And so I left. At first, I was just homeschooling the kids in our new town because they still couldn't go to in-person school. Sometime during that time, I got approached by Art Gnome, Jason Bailey, who was starting a new startup and was looking for a finance and operations person. My brother is the CTO of Club NFT and Right Click Save. He knew that I wasn't working and thought, oh, would you be interested? I really didn't know anything about Web3 or NFTs. My sort of snobby attitude towards them coming from the traditional art world was like, oh, isn't that monkey PFPs or whatever? I didn't really understand that there was this whole really incredible art world side of it. So Jason, Art Gnome, was my entry to that world. He sent me some Tezos. He set up a wallet for me, walked me through, at that time, Hikkett-Nunk, which is where he spent a lot of time collecting and where I started doing my first collecting. I started working with him for this company. And that was my entry into Web3, which is the best possible entry, to have someone like him who's been there since the early days, hand-holding me and exposing me to great artists and how everything works. And yeah, so ever since then, I've been collecting and I guess being a builder or whatever in the space. And then more recently, oh gosh, a little less than a year ago, I started making art and minting it. So that's been my journey along the way. I've been doing some curating and some writing as well. Sorry, that was very long-winded.
Was a perfect introduction. Thank you. So the pandemic definitely changed many people's lives, I would say, or changed the trajectory of many people's lives. And I feel the digital art space certainly offers many unique opportunities that the traditional art world may not provide. What aspects of the digital art space excite you personally most? Is this because it's a global art movement, or is that people can have so many different roles like you do have?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both of those things. I think the first thing that really drew me in was the community, the art. I mean, there's amazing art, which I immediately was, I don't know, shocked by. I was like, oh, there's this whole corner of the art world that I, having been in the traditional legacy, whatever you want to call it, art world, like totally didn't really have on my radar. And then the community that I very quickly fell into through sort of the Tezos community, FX Hash, et cetera, was just incredible. I made a lot of really great friends. And especially during the pandemic, where you couldn't really see people in person, having the ability to have this community, make friends with people all around the world. Like you said, it really truly is global. So yeah, the community, the global aspect. And for sure, I think in Web3, it's much more acceptable, if not the norm, to wear multiple hats, right? To be a collector and an artist, or a curator and a writer, or all of those things. Whereas in the legacy art world, you're a lot more, those things are siloed. And you're, if you do one of them, you're pigeonholed as that's what you do. There are exceptions, of course, but it's, yeah, everything's a lot more fluid here, which I appreciate a lot. And I think another thing that was very compelling and remains compelling and important to me personally as a collector and as an artist is the secondary royalty system. I think having worked in the US art world for a very long time and seeing artists struggle when they're first coming up, people are buying their works for relatively cheap. And then if they reach a degree of success later in life and those things sell at auction for millions of dollars, they tend to not see any of that money, because in the US, there are no laws about that. I know in some European countries it's different, but yeah, I think that is something about Web3 that immediately appealed to me and seemed a lot more fair. So all of those things, I think.
As you mentioned, you're someone who wears many hats in the art world. I wondered, what are your goals or the individual goals as an artist, collector, and curator?
Oh my goodness, that's a big question.
We need to brainstorm.
Yeah. I guess as a collector, I don't have any set goals per se, in the sense of, oh, I want to sell my collection and make this amount of money, or I want to whatever, two times, or I'm not really that kind of collector. That said, of course, I do sell things here and there, particularly to reinvest it into more art. I think my sort of main collecting goal is just to support artists. I think this is a way that, you know, even if it's in a small way, even if it's just a few Tez, that I can help artists continue on their journey. And if I see people who I like their work, I like them as a person, I want to support their ability to keep doing that. So that's my overarching goal. And also to support artists who maybe aren't getting as much attention. I started out with not a lot of Tez, and I really am not like a whale type collector. So I'm not collecting really like the blue chip kind of things. I more prefer to discover artists who are a little under the radar, or who are just starting out, or are from places where they aren't as hooked into the various networks that other artists might be hooked into. So I think that's my sort of broad answer about collecting goals. As a curator, it depends on what I'm curating, the show, etc. I think one big goal of mine has always been to spotlight female artists, women artists in the space. I think There are so many super, super talented female artists. And unfortunately, if you look at the numbers, they still don't command the prices that the big male artists do, even the most successful female artists. Anything I can do to put a spotlight on women artists and help change that by including them in exhibitions and in curations, that's something that's important to me personally. As an artist, oh goodness, that's the toughest one. I honestly don't really know what my goals are. I just keep making stuff. And if it resonates with people, that's great. And obviously, it enables me to collect more in this sort of a never-ending cycle. But really, just as it has always been for me, making work is the way that I work through things and process things, my feelings, what's going on in the world. And it's just something that I need to do for me. And I think I just want to keep creating, keep learning. I think I don't want to stagnate, especially in the field of AI. There's so much innovation. There's so many new tools and so many new ways to explore art making. So I want to keep learning. That's an important goal of mine, but I don't have some big end goal. Have a retrospective at MoMA or something. That would be amazing if that ever happened someday. But yeah, I just want to keep learning, keep creating, because it's, yeah, it's just something I need to do.
Maybe one day you will have a big goal as an artist as well. You mentioned that you just started a year ago, right, with creating. And I find it just so impressive, the quality of work that you already generated. It's very impressive.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. Yeah. Just to be clear, I only started creating digital art a year ago. I've been an artist creator my whole life. I started when I was really little. I got like a Polaroid camera when I was, I don't know, 7 or 8, and I was obsessed with photography ever since. So in college, I studied art history and studio art. My main focus was photography, but I also did some filmmaking and some mixed media. I've always been making art, just starting to be able to use these digital tools and particularly AI tools. It has been the more recent thing in the past year or so. And it's been great because I'm not in a school setting anymore. I don't have a dark room and space and all of these tools to make art in the way that I did in the past. And so to be able to do sort of everything on my computer has been really wonderful.
Yeah, as you mentioned that currently art is mainly a way for you to process emotions. So I think you're referring to internal goals, I assume. But I think with time passes, you may have also external goals like exhibiting at MoMA and other things. That would be cool to see one day.
Yeah, totally. And I do have like sort of soft goals of being in more exhibitions and things like that. And I've been accomplishing some of those things along the way, but I'm hesitant to put, I don't know. I'm just seeing where this path takes me because it's been this kind of wonderful surprise to be in my mid-40s and have this sort of creative renaissance that I didn't really expect to happen. So I'm just very grateful and happy to see where it goes without putting too much pressure on it.
Absolutely. So we will definitely talk more about your artwork. But first, I would also like to hear when it comes to, for you as a collector or curator, when it comes to valuing a piece of artwork, what factors do you consider most important when valuing a piece of work, when you're, for instance, curating for exhibition?
I don't really think of it so much in terms of value. Obviously, in this Web3 NFT space, it's financialized, so everything, you know, has a price and it's transparent and everyone sees that. For me, in my personal collecting, it's really, does it make me feel something? Does it tell a story? Does it hit me in the gut, essentially? And if it does one of those things or more, then it's just, can I afford it? I don't have an unlimited budget, so that does come into account. And then in terms of curating, again, it's those criteria, but then also with an eye to some sort of theme or some sort of topic that I'm trying to address in the curation. And again, trying to bring in voices that maybe are less heard in this space, whether it's women or people who aren't from America or Europe. So yeah, it depends on the context, but really a lot of it goes down to that gut feeling. I've seen a lot of art in my life. I've been lucky working in the art world for so long and also just being a student and lover of art history. I think if something catches my eye and makes me feel something, then that's it's hard to put a price on that. And obviously, you have to put prices on these things. And a lot of times I see things and it's, wow, that's incredible. I can't afford that, but good for that person. And I'll retweet it or share it because just because I can't collect something doesn't mean I can't be a fan of it. So, yeah, I don't know if that's like the best answer to that question, but that's what I've got.
Intuition. I accept it. So this space definitely slowed down quite a bit since more than a year now, but still, it's still a fast-paced place. And I wonder, how do you keep up with the amount that's like coming out every day, and where do you source of content? Is this mainly Twitter or through personal collections that you value the art and all these creative contents that's out there?
Yeah, it is a lot. And I definitely spend, according to my husband, way too much time on Twitter and now on Instagram, which I reluctantly joined like a couple months ago. I only joined Twitter, gosh, like a year and a half, 2 years ago, basically for my job. I had been really anti-social media for like my whole life or whatever, since whenever social media came about. But as in this space, like everything happens on Twitter, Discord, to a certain extent, Instagram, et cetera. Yeah, it's a lot to keep up with for sure. I find I'm monitoring those things a lot. I follow a lot of other collectors whose taste I like. And a lot of collectors do the same with me. And I think I coined the term, maybe someone else has come up with it, but I often either frenable or am frenabled by my collector friends, which basically is you see your friend post about something or tweet about something. Oh, I just collected this, or check out this artist. And then you, oh man, that's amazing. Who is that? And you start following that artist and you collect their work. And it's this wonderful virtuous cycle of us helping each other find new art and new artists. And yeah, I think I also am pretty active in terms of other IRL events in the space. I try to go to things as I can, when I can, see a lot of art out there in that way, get to have like real conversations and meet people in person, which is wonderful. And being part of the team at Right Click Save, reading the articles, getting to know the people, like the writers and the curators and the artists that are a part of those pieces, I think is something that has been wonderful for me in terms of discovery, just knowing what's going on out there. The content is really amazing. And I would say that even if I didn't work there. So yeah, I think it is a lot. It is overwhelming. I do need to sometimes draw a line and say, okay, I'm stepping away from the technology and I'm going to go to the beach with my kids or whatever and turn it all off. But I am for sure constantly watching. And it is probably a bit of an addiction, but I guess there could be worse addictions.
I agree. Casper has some questions for you, but I also first want just to mention that I really love the content of Right Click Save. I read many articles and also listened to the podcast Right Click Save Radio. And so it's great.
Amazing. Thank you. Yeah, our editor-in-chief, Alex Esterick, is incredible. He, I think, just does such an amazing job producing content that really spans topics, spans the globe, just really incredible stuff. And yeah, and I'm glad you listened to the podcast too. I think I've been on it once or twice, but
I listened to that episode where you've been on. Casper, go ahead. You have some questions for Danielle.
Yeah, thanks, June. Hi, Danielle. Obviously, welcome to the show. Super interested in your personal journey when you started in the arts, studying art history, and I see from LinkedIn visual and environmental studies. And then hopping to an MBA from Yale, no less. And then, of course, your current professional track is more back in the arts, right? So could you talk about a little bit about that kind of journey for listeners to understand a bit about how that contributes to what you're doing now?
Sure. Yeah, of course. Yeah. So visual environmental studies was Harvard's weird, convoluted name for a major that basically combined studio art and art history. And I think they've changed it since. I got some email that they changed the name of the department. But yeah, I had always, as I mentioned before, always loved photography, studied it in high school, went on to study it in college, among other things. But I, throughout that whole time, I was super dedicated to my work and made this great community of artists, friends, studied with some amazing teachers, including Nan Golden, who came for a semester and taught a small seminar. But I always knew that I like wasn't going to be a practicing artist as a profession, or at least that wasn't what I was going to try to come out of undergrad and do. I was the first person in my family to go to college. I came from a working class family. I didn't have really anything to fall back on. So my main priority when I was graduating was like, okay, I got to get a job that can pay my bills and help me pay down my student loans and all that. Yeah. So I moved to San Francisco. I took a corporate job. I still kept doing photography. I actually, when I lived in San Francisco, I taught photography to kids on the weekends. There was this like photography mentorship program that I did. So that was a nice way of keeping me like still creating, still doing something creative and being in a dark room. But from there, my career really was focused on having the ability to sustain myself. I did want to remain in the arts just because it's like the world that I love. So I wound up working at, I moved to New York after that and wound up working at PS1 Contemporary Art Center, which is now a part of MoMA, but it used to be its own standalone, very avant-garde contemporary art space. And I love that job. It was amazing. But somewhere along the line, I realized my strengths were in the organizational and financial side. So I went to business school. As you mentioned, I went to Yale. I got my MBA and always meant to and intended to come back to the art world. But when I graduated and in between my first and second year, I worked as an investment banker on Wall Street. Again, got to pay off those loans. But I also thought it would be a really good experience and I would learn a lot, which I did. It was quite a learning experience. I was actually at Lehman Brothers, which, as some of you might know, was like the crux of a huge like financial collapse. And I was there for that. So that was super interesting. That would be a whole nother podcast to talk about that. So I was part of the acquisition by Barclays Capital, which is a British bank. So I didn't lose my job somehow amongst all that. And I kept working there for a while. But yeah, I really wanted to get back to the arts. And then I got this amazing sort of dream job at MoMA, managing sort of finance operations and hiring for the painting and sculpture department, which is the big curatorial department there, working side by side, hand in hand with the chief curator, Ann Temkin. And it was amazing. And I worked there for 8 years and loved every minute of it. And learned a ton from the curators. One of the main things I worked on there was acquisitions. So when we want to bring new things into the collection, we have to put it through a board vote. So we bring in the work, we install it, we do this big song and dance, slideshow, dossiers and write-ups about the pieces. The curators present them, board members ask questions. And then after all that, if the works are accepted, then I handled all of the paperwork in terms of the legal documents and the purchasing or the deeds of gift, if it's a gift. And so that was an amazing process, getting to shepherd new art into the collection and see the kind of thinking that went into that and be part of the thinking that went into that. Yeah. So then I'd been there for almost a decade. I was feeling like I needed some sort of new challenge. And I got approached by a gallery in Chelsea to essentially run their finance and operations. So I left to do that. And yeah, then about a year into that is when the pandemic hit. And then I told you the story from there. So I think it's been a little bit of a wandering road, but also weirdly, it's all made perfect sense in terms of getting me where I am. Yeah, I wouldn't really change any of it because it's all been super influential in terms of making me like the person I am and the artist I am. And also, obviously, having the career and the jobs that I have now.
Yeah, that's really amazing. There's nothing weird at all about your achievements. And this just struck me, right? Would you happen to have read this book by Christina Wallace called The Portfolio Life?
No, I haven't, but it sounds like something I should read. Can you tell me a bit about it?
It's exactly like what you describe. Christina is a Harvard Business School professor who started in the art world. And exactly like your journey, she started in the arts. And the book is about building multiple income streams to have a very resilient life, right? So that no one hit in this pandemic-stricken world can ever bring you down catastrophically. And it's precisely what you describe, like having a life that's not just focused on a single career track, but having interest in the arts, something like if you're interested in science and numbers, it doesn't mean you're a weird person. It just means you have multiple interests and you can build a portfolio of income streams. And she calls herself a human Venn diagram. So I think if you have time, everyone on this show should... I might sound a little bit of like a fanboy. I'm not paid to do this, but I definitely gleaned a lot from that book. I thought you would have read that book because your life sounds exactly a perfect advertisement for what you would have been describing
That's so
in
funny.
A book.
Yeah,
yeah,
no, now I'm definitely going to read it. That sounds incredible. And I do think that it is true that having a diversity of different things that you're interested in or competent or even better than competent at is obviously a very helpful thing, particularly if you're a person who has always historically worried about money and about stability. It definitely helps when something like the pandemic hits. You do feel a little bit more secure in your footing, right? If you have these other things that you can do and other ways to look at the world. Yeah, I know. I'm excited to read that book. I feel like it will resonate a lot with me.
Yeah, I think it will definitely resonate with you. And I just found the writing style and all that pretty easy to follow. Yeah. But anyway, really impressive resume and really great to hear your story of how you managed to connect the dots somehow from the art world to finance and then back again. That's a really amazing story. Really inspiring.
Oh,
Thanks.
thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, when I was at PS1, it was an incredible job. I was the assistant to the director, who at that time was the founder, Alana Heiss, an incredible visionary woman. If you don't know of her, look her up. She's just, yeah, she's a powerhouse. And she's still around, like putting together shows, running a radio station. And she's probably in her 80s now. But anyway, so I was her assistant. And then I also took on the additional role of managing special events, which included, we had this like radio broadcast slash boat that we did at the Venice Biennale, where we had live radio, where we interviewed all different artists, Ed Ruscha, all these different people, and then also had parties on the boat. So I was in charge of all of that. And it was this amazing, manic, crazy, fun time. But one of the things that I noticed, and having a sort of like numbers brain and being like a hyper-organized type A person, was that the way that PS1 operated at that time, and again, this was before MoMA took over and became like the parent of PS1, it was very haphazard. I remember we would be installing a show and have a week till opening, and we'd still be short on funding. And Alana would be like, would be going through her Rolodex, figuring out like which wealthy patron can we call to help get us the money at this 11th hour or whatever. So I just looked at that and I was like, oh man, like this could be done better. Institutions often have a creative visionary helming the ship who have these great ideas, but they also need people who know how to make those things happen and can put in place the structures and help figure out timelines and budgets and all of that stuff. And I just saw that and I figured this isn't the only place, the only creative place that probably has this issue. And that's what pushed me to go to business school, because I thought if I could get a real footing in all of that and come back to this world, that I could help out with that. So that was the idea there. And I guess that is what I did. And so it worked out in the end, even though for a lot of people, they were, what, you're going to business school? Like, what are you doing? It was confusing to my art friends, but.
Yeah, but you managed to connect the dots in the end. So That's what's important. And obviously, I'm always very excited to see people from Harvard and Yale being in the Web3 space and confirming that we're all in the right space.
Yeah. No, I think obviously not financial advice. You said it at the beginning, but do really see this digital art Web3 movement as something that is like, we're in obviously in the early stages, but that it's not going away. And it is already getting the attention of the institutions, whether it be museums, major traditional art world galleries, auction houses. And I think they are just, particularly the institutions, because they're slower moving and they also have an educational mission, et cetera. They're really grappling with trying to get their head around it and understand it. But I think they're trying, and that's an important thing, and that's a great thing. And I think they're going to get there, and I don't think it's going away. And I'm really excited to see where it goes. And same with AI. I think that's also something that everybody is grappling, and it's changing so fast. But I think we're people who have been in this space collecting and making art with AI and believing in it and having conviction in it, like it's not going away. And if you view it as an opportunity and something that's exciting and something that is a tool that can be used in lots of really amazing ways in the creative world, then yeah, I think there's just a lot that can happen. And I'm excited to, I'm here for it.
Yep, that's precisely why we're all here for it. I wouldn't hog more of the question and answer time. Thanks so much, Danielle, for your answers. Espresso, I think you had a question.
Yeah, thanks, Caspar. And yeah, first of all, also so fascinating to hear your story, Danielle, and all of these different aspects. I'm also a big fan of building many different skills and finding ways to combine them. I think that's a great strength overall. And my question is related to what you just mentioned about the traditional art world, the institutions, and you've probably gotten this question 1,000 times already. Is there something we should be focusing on doing in Web3 and digital art to get on the radar for these institutions? Or do you think they'll get there by themselves, or something we should focus on?
That's
creating
a great
more
question.
Content?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think my answer to that is I think we need more discourse, more analysis, not to tout right-click save again, but I think that having thoughtful writing about this space and about the artists in this space and the work that's being made, I think that's very important. I think thoughtful curation, having exhibitions, both IRL and online, that have a lot of thought behind them, that have, you know, crafted written pieces that accompany them. I was absolutely thrilled when I did the Muses, which you mentioned at the top, my generative AI project on mprops. Annika Meyer wrote this incredible piece. I was totally blown away by it and really just honored. She's a great writer, a great curator. And the piece that she wrote to accompany that show really connected what I was doing with that project to art history in lots of different really smart ways. And I think that's the kind of thing that the traditional / legacy art world, that's what's going to hook them in, right? They want to understand, how does this connect to what we understand, which is like the traditional art historical canon. And I think they're also going to need a little bit of handholding on the technology side of it. I think crypto and blockchain and all of that is super confusing, especially if you're not like a super tech savvy person. When I worked at MoMA, there was one person, a curator who'd been in the department for years and years. She didn't even really use her computer. Like every so often she'd call me and she'd be writing an email and she'd need my help to do a pretty simple thing like in writing her email. So I'm not to say that everybody in museums is that old fashioned, but there is this old guard, particularly in some of the bigger, older institutions, that the technology stuff is going to be a hurdle, right? So making that stuff understandable, I think, is also important. But yeah, I really think the critical discourse, having thoughtful conversations, whether it's symposia, articles, thought pieces, exhibitions with really thoughtful text, I think that is going to help get them on board. And they are already doing a lot of the work for themselves. I was talking to a colleague at MoMA, and there's some sort of like reading and discussion group that they have around Web3 with a bunch of different people from different departments and different museums, like thinking on these topics. So they're thinking about it. But I do think they need folks who are natively in this world to also help them and provide some context and just show that the artists that are making this work are serious. A lot of the artists who are minting work on the blockchain have been artists for years and years. They might have a painting practice or a performance art practice or whatever it is. And what they're doing in Web3 is just an extension and continuation of that. I think it's just important to ground all of this for the people that are coming from that more traditional art world side. If that makes sense. Sorry, I think that was a bit of a babble.
Yeah, no, that was great. Thank you. And yeah, that makes total sense. And you were right that so many of the artists that we are collecting in the digital art space have made art for a long time, long before Web3. This is more like just the medium in some manner. So yeah, and of course, as content creators, we also love to focus on that part of it and try to contribute in that way. Thank you.
Sure, no problem. And one other thing just to add to that, that I think is helpful, not so much maybe for the like traditional art world curators, et cetera, but just for the general public to understand what we're doing and to make a connection to it, is I do think that when possible, it is wonderful and important to have IRL exhibitions of this work, whether it be with beautiful screens, particularly if the work is animated or has sound, or to have beautiful prints, if the work is 2D work, plotter prints or whatever, to show people, hey, look, this is art, right? A lot of people think of art as like something in a frame on a wall. And if we can show them some things on a wall that look beautiful, that speak to them, and then say, oh, and by the way, this is also a digital asset. And it's on this thing called the blockchain, which will forever show the ownership and the history and the provenance. Like, I think that is a way to make connections with some more traditional collectors and just art lovers who maybe aren't scrolling Twitter all the time to see art and don't have a virtual metaverse gallery and wouldn't even understand how to do that. So I think getting these things out into the world when possible and when it makes sense and done properly is also an important way to broaden audience.
Yeah, that makes sense. And also seeing this has been a big trend over the last year, I guess maybe more, with lots of different events from different Web3 organizations like FXH has had live events and has had lots of success with physical gallery showings of digital art, more of this. So yeah, back to you, Ian.
Yeah, thank you for this really interesting discussion, Espresso and Daniel. We have less than 20 minutes left, and I was thinking let's talk a bit about your art project. So we mentioned a bit the Muses, and it's really an amazing project, not only because it's one of the first long-form generative AI projects on the platform Mprops, basically combining AI technology with the concept of randomness that we already know from code-based generative art. And I still remember, like, at the beginning of the year, I was chatting with Espresso about the idea to combine these two together and ask him whether he knows any of these type of project. And he mentioned Mprops, and here Daniel is. So I'm really glad that we could make this happen. So Daniel, you explored the concept of femininity in an art historic context in this project. And first, I think you mentioned that the AI mashups that you did previously, they served as kind of experimental playground for the muses before you worked on that project. Is this right?
Yeah. Yeah. I first started, when I started working with AI and minting work, my first series were these AI mashups, which I continue to this day here and there, basically blending the styles of different artists or sometimes fashion designers or filmmakers or just other creatives and seeing how does AI interpret that and what do these imaginary collaborations look like. And when I was doing those, it would just serve me up a lot of portraits of women. And that makes sense, right? Because the data set is trained on like all of art history, and all of art history, there's been a lot of depictions of women, a very common theme. So I started seeing all these women and I just became very interested in them and thinking a lot about the depiction of women throughout art history and like the male gaze and the female gaze and how female artists depict themselves or other women versus how male artists do. And yeah, it definitely sparked the thinking that eventually became the muses. And then with the muses, I just delved fully into it and really tried to take a broad capture of artists from the Renaissance up until now, including contemporary painters, and just continue to investigate these tropes and how the AI sometimes does interesting or strange things with them. Yeah, but I don't know. Do you want to hear about the process, or I'm happy to talk as much as you want about it?
Yeah, definitely would love to hear a bit about the project. And I was mainly also wondering, did you curate some, how should I say that? So I know, for instance, that for artificial self-portrait, you mentioned that you actually created a set of outputs that you basically used to train your project or use as an input. So I wonder whether you did something similar for the muses, that you actually had an already pre-curated set of images that you used to feed into the AI system. I think you used Stable Diffusion for that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so the artificial self-portraits, that was actually self-portraits of myself from when I was in art school. So those are actual like analog pictures of me that I took like with a camera and a tripod and a timer like more than 20 years ago. And I used those as the inputs into Midjourney and then with prompts changed them and made them into the set of 10 artificial self-portraits that resulted for that exhibition that Expanded Art and the NFT gallery did. And that was just like a real deep dive delve into the multiplicity of self, how memory is flawed, and how even just conjuring up a memory and then the second layer of putting that memory into AI and how the AI interprets it changes things. That was how I did that. For the muses, it was different. So I used Stable Diffusion, which is the tool that Mprops uses, which was new to me. I had to learn it. I had always used Midjourney prior to that. So my first step was like, okay, I got to figure out how Stable Diffusion works and how it's different. And what I eventually came to using for the project was I had a set of source images, a lot, I think it was about 10 or 11 portraits of women that I chose to use. And I went through probably hundreds when testing, working on the project. Some of them by women, some of them by men, from all different eras, different poses, different styles. And so those were the 10 or 11 options of a source image. And then I had an equal amount, whether it was 10 or 11, I forget now, of prompts that I had crafted. And again, tons of trial and error. Those prompts featured generally three different creatives, usually painters, and then a fashion designer. There's always a designer in there to help get the clothes or the style to be a certain way, along with tons of other words. So basically the way that the sort of generative random system worked is that I had all of these source images, I had all of these prompts, and then I also had all of these different settings in Stable Diffusion, and I had different probabilities that I assign to different settings. So, okay, 20% will be at this setting, 30% will be at that setting, et cetera. So there are a lot of different levers to pull, and I assign probabilities to the different source images and to the different prompts. And also, I came up with a list of 1,000 names. I hand curated 1,000 names, and the coders coded it so that each name could only be used once, and there would be 500 unique names attached to the outputs. And with all that, the code was set up so that when you minted, depending on the different probabilities, you would roll some combination of source image, prompt, the various settings and weights and things that I set for in Stable Diffusion, and the name. And out popped your muse. And so I had no idea what these were going to look like. The final 500 were a surprise to me and the collector. But of course, I had done a ton of testing and training. We had done test runs over and over and tweaked things here and there along the way. So I had some sense of what I hoped the overall project would look like, but definitely was giving up control to the gods of randomness in the end. Yeah, that's how it works. And I was really happy with how it turned out. It was obviously successful, which I was super surprised and pleased about. But I also felt like it was the right combination of diverse in terms of the outputs looking different and unique, but also feeling like a cohesive collection. So I hope other people felt that. But yeah, that's how that worked.
Totally. This is what really impressed me most. We all stayed around with AI art. And I think creating portraits or just human figures that look good, it's not so easy with AI, and particularly to create consistently good outputs like in your project. It's really amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, it is really hard. And it was funny because one of the main things that I tried to do with my prompts, like my positive prompts and my negative prompts in Stable Diffusion, was I was trying to avoid really weird or ugly or messy or just crazy outputs. So I tried to avoid multiple heads or nudity or different things that I didn't envision as being part of the project. But as AI does what AI does. And so there are a number of outputs where there's two women or two heads, or there's a few naked ladies. And of course, because those are rare, a lot of the collectors really sought those out. Those became ooh, look, I got a double-headed one, or I bought this double-headed one from the secondary because it's so cool or whatever. And that was something I went into the process knowing. I knew there would be these sort of edge cases, and that's part of it. That's part of what AI is at this moment in time, right? I envision in the not too distant future, all of that stuff will be gone and it'll be too perfect, right? There will be no weird, quirky AI artifacts. And so I'm glad that this project captured a lot of those AI quirks of this moment in time. It's a record or a document of what the tool is at this moment. But that said, I didn't want them all to be totally weird and wonky. So I think it was a decent mix in the end.
I think it was a perfect mixture of edge cases. There are some pieces with two heads. When I saw them, I actually thought, oh, these are actually pretty cool outputs. Yeah, very cool. I actually also really like your artificial self-portrait collection on expanded art that you created. They just look so good. So yeah, very impressed.
Thank you so much. That's really kind. Yeah, it's funny because not one of them looks like me. There's not any one of those 10 that if you looked at me in person, even back then, whatever, 20 years ago when I was young, you wouldn't be like, oh, that looks just like you. But they all have an aspect of me. And what was important to me was that they all captured an emotion or an aspect of myself that I really remember from that time, or that these original self-portraits captured. So it was okay, how do I capture that using AI? And AI is, of course, going to make me look different because that's what it does. I didn't want a picture that was just a slightly different version of the same picture I was using as the source image. I wanted, the whole point was to play with that, but still make them feel authentic and make you feel like you might have known this person, or that you might be that person, right? You can remember back in your youth or when you were in your teens or 20s, that emotion, that feeling that I think everybody can relate to certain aspects of, or at least one of the aspects that those portraits show. So yeah, it was this sort of way of investigating my memories, investigating my past, but without having to really reveal actual me. Also seeing how the AI kind of changes my memories. Like the more I worked with it, the more like it dredged things up. And then it was like, am I remembering this like correctly? Is the AI like affecting how I remember this? Yeah, it all gets mixed up in an interesting way.
Yeah, when I read the description about this project, it really made me think for the first time that as time goes on, our memory actually can change quite a bit, particularly of events that happened in the past. And when you actually worked with this, did you get emotional maybe? Because sometimes I feel like I get reminded of things in the past. It's really nostalgic sometimes.
Oh, yeah, for sure. There was a lot of nostalgia, definitely a lot of emotion. It was interesting because looking back at the source photographs that I took, these self-portraits from when I was in college, I just wanted to hug that girl because I can remember so, so clearly and distinctly like how I felt and all of these things that were really difficult or things I was struggling with. And now having 20 plus years of experience and wisdom and what in life, I look back and I just want to tell her like, it's going to be okay. You're great. It's fine. Don't worry about these things. And so, yeah, there was that. There was definitely a lot of, and there's happy nostalgia too, remembering good times. It wasn't like this terrible, tragic time. I don't want to paint it as that, but I think everybody in their teens and 20s, it's like a turbulent time. You're figuring out who you are. There's a lot of emotions. There's a lot of hormones, whatever. So yeah, I think my overarching feeling during it was just feeling incredibly tender and almost protective of this girl who was me. I also have kids. And so I think that affects how I look at things as well. I feel very motherly towards her in a way that like maybe I wouldn't have 10 years ago or something. Maybe I would have judged her more harshly.
I love your answer. I think it's also some sort of self-acceptance maybe. So that just if you remembering yourself back when you've been younger and going through process, struggle and worries and all these things, but you just view this from a different point now. And
yeah, 100%. Definitely like self-acceptance and also just realizing like how much more critical you are of yourself than other people are. I think like when you're younger, or at least for me, I felt like everyone's always judging me. I felt very worried about all these different things. And the older you get, the older you realize like people are mostly just worrying about themselves and wrapped up in their own stuff. They're not usually noticing you as much as you think. You're not the star of their movie. You're like some ancillary character. Yeah. It definitely helps to think about that.
Yeah. I wish we all knew this 20 years ago.
I know, right? Right?
Saved so much.
I wish I could have told myself, but I don't think she would have listened. I think she still would have thought she was the star of every movie and had to be perfect in all ways. Yeah, but yeah. I think about that with my kids. Oh, I want to teach them all these lessons so that they don't struggle the way I did with this or that, but you have to learn for yourself, right? And the more someone tries to tell you something, you're just not going to listen. So that's just life.
Absolutely. You have to go through your own journey. That's just part of life. So yeah, I want to just quickly mention the current project, or you already did it. So you created pieces, or basically mashup pieces for Pedro Winery. And we had Anna from Scales last week here also talking a bit about that because she was also collaborating on that project. And do you want to mention a bit about what you've been working on for Pedro?
Sure. Sure. Yeah. And I see Anna here. Hi, Anna. I was lucky to get to meet her. Peju flew the artists for this project out to Napa. And we had this glorious time where we got to tour the winery and meet the family who runs it and eat delicious food and obviously drink a lot of wonderful wine and experience the beautiful landscape and grounds. And it was basically like an inspiration trip. And then we all went back home and created our work. And it was just so incredible. Meeting and spending time with the other artists was so great to do that IRL, which is something that like I don't really get to do much. And yeah, and just hearing the story of the winery, it's this family-run winery. And right now, the two sisters run it together. They also have a female winemaker, which is like pretty rare and fabulous. And it's this auction of our pieces is going to benefit a nonprofit in the Bay Area that supports domestic violence survivors. So it's just all for a really good cause with a great business that has been a really big supporter of many great things in Napa Valley. Yeah. So after that trip, I came back, worked on my pieces. What I basically did was I took a lot of photographs while I was there. The landscape and the grounds were just so stunningly beautiful. I took a lot of photographs of flowers and of the winery and the grapes themselves. And they have a lot of actually artwork around the buildings and also sculptures and things on the grounds. And using the photographs I took, I worked with them in AI and came up with my two pieces. And the pieces are, again, kind of these AI mashups. One of them is a mashup of the Alma Thomas and Hilma af Klint, and one is a mashup of Hilma and Henri Matisse. And basically trying to capture some of that beauty of the landscape there. And both of the pieces have a central female figure. It was important. A, I have a lot of women in my art, so it's like on brand for me. But B, it was important for me to have a woman be a central and important part of these pieces, since this is such a sort of strong female-led winery, and what they're doing to support this shelter is obviously hugely supportive of women who are absolutely in need of that support. Yeah, so that was how I came up with the works. And there's going to be an auction. I believe it'll be online. People can participate online starting July 24th. They're having like a little cocktail or whatever wine party on the 21st out in Napa. If you're there, it's free. You should RSVP, go to the PayJu site. You should go. It'll be amazing. I will not be there. I'll be in Spain. Don't feel sorry for me, but I am sad to miss it. But the auction, essentially, each artist, there's six female artists that they have as part of this. We each created two one-of-one unique pieces. And if you win the bidding, you get a physical piece, you get the NFT, which is a one-of-one NFT, and you get a magnum bottle of their top-rated Cabernet with the label featuring our art. And that's a one-of-one wine bottle that you'll have, the only one with that label. So it's very cool. I am super honored to be a part of it. And also just like the company that I'm keeping with the other artists, like you mentioned, Anna Serrana, otherwise known as Aslan Ruby. She's one of the artists. Wildy, it's a great group. I definitely highly encourage people to go to the PayJu website and check out. There's like bios of each of us and pictures of the works that we created. It's pretty spectacular. I will see if I can scrounge up enough coin to bid on some of my fellow artists' work, because I am just like blown away by what people created. It's pretty fantastic.
Yeah, amazing. I read the website on PayJu Winery and also the story behind the winery. I found it very fascinating. And I think it's a very innovative way to combine two apparently completely different businesses, art and winery, together, even for a good cause. So it's pretty cool, I think.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I love wine, but I'm not like really an expert. And I actually am one of those people, because I'm a visual person and I love art, I definitely, I'll go into a wine shop, and if there's like a bottle with a really great label, I will definitely choose that bottle over another bottle. I think the wine label design and the art on wine labels like is a thing. And actually PayJu has done art like labels before on different wines they've had, but this is the first time that they've done it in such a big way, and that they've done it to support a charity, and it's also in conjunction with their 40th anniversary being a winery. So it's very special, and I'm super excited to be part of it, and I hope you all check it out. Not even selfishly like wanting you to see my work or bid on my work, but it's just a really cool project, and all of the artists involved are just incredible.
I agree. So will you be creating a show at NFT Show Europe, right?
Yes, yeah.
That's what you will be in Spain next month.
Yeah.
Very exciting, yeah.
No, I'm super excited. I curated, along with two other friends, FX Hash's presentation for NFT Show Europe last year. And then for this year, the NFT Show Europe gang approached me and asked to curate a show of my choosing, whatever theme I want. And I decided to do a show called Embodied, basically featuring women artists creating works that somehow investigate the body, whether it be tied to motherhood and childbearing, whether it be tied to body image, whether it be tied to violence, or any of these very fraught topics around the body. So I selected, was it 5 or 6 artists that I pre-curated that I knew worked in this vein and had work that I really loved and wanted to show. And then there was also an open call to select 5 or 6 people from the open call for the show. So yeah, I think it's going to be really great. I'm excited. And while I'm there, I'm also going to be, I think, moderating a panel and on a panel about AI art. So they're going to keep me nice and busy, but I'm really excited. I've actually never been to Spain. I've been to lots of other places in Europe, but not Spain. So I'm going to travel a bit afterwards as well, which will be a nice thing to do.
Amazing. I think you're the perfect person to curate such a theme. And yeah, we're at the end of space. And I think it was really fascinating and interesting conversation and to hear all your insights and your life experiences. So thank you very much, Danielle. Very happy to have connected with you here.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Danielle, for coming on the show.
I love this. This was a great chat. I appreciate you inviting me.
Thank you, Daniel, for joining us here today. And I hope you enjoyed your walk. And I loved hearing your birds in the background. And enjoy the rest of your Sunday. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in.
Well, in time.